Good morning, everyone. We are here for our first case, AC Equities LP versus County of Union and County and Union County Improvement Authority. Can we have appearances of counsel, please?
Good morning, Louis Raynon, Raynon Coughlin Michello, appearing on behalf of the Union County Improvement Authority.
Good morning, Thomas Abate, Dakotas Fitzpatrick, Colin Giblin, on behalf of the County of Union.
Good morning, Matthew Boxer from Lowenstein Sandler, on behalf of the respondent, HC Equities.
Good morning, Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Welcome all. Mr. Raynon, I understand you're arguing first, so the floor is yours.
That is correct. Thank you. If it pleases the court. First, let me begin by thanking everybody. Obviously, this has become routine for you, but it's novel to some of us to argue a case before this court over Zoom. But I guess it works, and I feel like sometimes that maybe it's just me because the last time I argued a case before this court, there was a gas leak in the building, and the argument was put off. So I hope that it's not just me. The Union County Improvement Authority and the County of Union are joint petitioners here, but they really play different roles. A County Improvement Authority, by its very nature, is responsible for performing projects, and in this case, on behalf of the county. The County Improvement Authority, as just historically in Union County, has been one that has been involved in all of the county's buildings in the last. And last decade, certainly, and maybe even more than that. So not unusually, when the county decided to look at its space needs in Elizabeth, it directed the Improvement Authority to undertake a study of all of the county's space needs. And they, in fact, commissioned, as would be the normal process, a consultant to review all of the county buildings and determine how best to proceed forward into the future. As we stand here today, the county is involved in a project to build a new administration building and to essentially implement the study that has now become the subject of this lawsuit. So in January of 2017, and in some way, which is still unclear, it's unclear to me, it was unclear to the appellate division, and it's never really been answered. The initial draft study of this space needs was somehow given to the plaintiff in this case. That began a series of correspondence between the Improvement Authority, the plaintiff's attorneys, and there are a number of law firms. There are the Mr. Box's law firm is here now, and they came in kind of a little bit later.
Well, we're familiar with the letters, Mr. Reno. Let's get to the notice of tort claim issue of substantial compliance that was found by the appellate division here, because that's the issue that brings you before the court.
It is. So the first thing I want to make clear is not even the plaintiff here, when they filed this lawsuit, believed that they had substantially complied in March of 2018 with the tort claim requirement. They filed a tort claim in June. They pled that they filed a tort claim notice in June. And then as the case began to develop procedurally, their position seemed to shift back and forth. At one point in time before the appellate division, the plaintiff argued that they could not have put the county on, the Improvement Authority on notice of trade libel, for instance, because they did not even have an action for trade libel because they didn't have special damages. I don't think when you look at these letters, if you're going to look at them in context, which is what the opinions of this court have told us we have to do, you have to look at the entire context. So first, I think that you have to look at the fact that these are sophisticated lawyers writing to governmental entities. And they're not even writing to the governmental entities, they're writing to, in my case, my partner, David Mancello, his general counsel to the Improvement Authority. And those letters to the Improvement Authority specifically dealt almost solely and exclusively with the position of the property owner of the plaintiff here, that they thought that they had a settlement of a prior lawsuit with the county and that the county was attempting to renege on that settlement. When you read those letters in that context, you do not ever reach the conclusion that they are talking about anything other than going back to court to enforce their settlement against the county. I understand that there is some throwaway language in these letters, and there are also, by the way, litigation hold language in these letters. But when you read the letters in together, it's pretty clear. By the way, they explain each other. Mr. Gruen's letter is to the county, and it says, we're going to sue you to enforce our settlement. So therefore, we're issuing a litigation hold, and you should keep all of the documents in place. The improvement authority, the letters to the improvement authority, they don't say we're damaged by your conduct. They say somehow we got a copy of this study and we want you to withdraw it. There's nothing in those letters. Excuse me.
Go ahead, Justice Albin.
Mr. Reno, do any of the letters set forth the causes of action that are articulated in the tort claims action notice, such as civil rights actions under 1983, the New Jersey Civil Rights Act, trade libel, conspiracy? Do any of those appear in any of the three letters?
When I look at, so let's be clear, you don't need to file a tort claim notice for the civil rights part of it. So, and you don't need to file a tort claims notice for the contract part of it. So there is a general, I believe that it was in the first letter from Mr. Fader, in which he lists generally tortious interference. There really is not a claim there for trade libel in any of those letters. That really is something that comes later when we see the actual tort claim notice. So those things are delineated there. By the way, there is no reference at all in the letters to civil rights violations or civil conspiracy. They are just, it's generally just a general fact pattern.
Before we move on to your February 22nd letter, just 1 second. The paragraph at the bottom of the second page, does that read as if it's a specific notice as required under the Tort Claims Act? Or is it conditional language of if you do something, then we will likely proceed? Is that sufficient, or has that ever been sufficient written notice for a tort claims notice?
I don't believe so. And it's in some respects, this reminds me a little bit of the notice in Newberry, which is they're telling us there was a car accident, but they really haven't told us that what it has to do with us or why it is that we caused any harm. So I think that's true. It is all conditional. And it is, if you don't withdraw the study, then we may do X, Y, or Z. And once again, the study was a draft study. It obviously wasn't withdrawn, and a tort claim notice was filed in June. But once again, it was all conditional. It was conditioned on whether or not the study would be withdrawn. And as to the improvement authority, there's really not a claim for it. And nowhere in here is there a claim that we damaged anybody. Their only suggestion to us is that we withdraw the study. So that I don't think that any of these letters put the improvement authority on notice that there's a claim against them. Once again, the central focus of all of these letters is whatever their the dispute over at the time, the dispute over whether or not the study was violative of a settlement agreement.
Let me stop you right there. The third letter is not even addressed to your client. It's addressed, the March 9th letter is addressed to County Council. We've talked about the February 22nd letter. Let's turn to the March 8th letter. That is one addressed to your firm.
Correct.
The language at the very end of Mr. Fader's letter seems to read equivocally. Our client wishes to avoid litigation. We request that the form be that the draft study be withdrawn. Again, you've said that substantial compliance has not been claimed against your client. The notice that was filed in June was not addressed to your client. If we look at these two letters, can you say that your client was reasonably informed of a claim, a specific claim, and an amount of damages that would be sought against your client as claims act requires?
And once again, and that's why I began by saying the county and the improvement authority are different here. As to the improvement authority, no, there's nothing in here that would give us any indication that this was anything other than a dispute between the plaintiff and the county. And you are exactly correct that this letter is equivocal with regards to the improvement authority, and it talks about what may happen if the improvement authority doesn't act. But once again, from the improvement authority's point of view, they weren't even the author of the study. They were the paid for the study, but they weren't the author of the study. So and there's nothing in these letters that indicates exactly what, for instance, if we're talking about trade libel, exactly what the defamatory nature of any conduct on behalf of what, how it is that that's tied to some action on behalf of the improvement authority.
The Tort Claim Act in 8.8-3 tells a claimant, a potential claimant, that they must provide notice as directed in the statute. And then 8-4 lays out the conditions of that notice. And they're basically time, place, and manner constituents of the information that must be conveyed. Can you address specifically what is lacking in respect of those three items vis-a-vis your client? Because the appellate division thought in combination, somehow there was substantial compliance of those three factors.
Well, once again, I think that this is, much like in Newberry, which I think is a prime example, they really do not lay out, for instance, what the operative conduct of the authority is that they claim has somehow damaged them. They merely acknowledge the fact it's a draft report, and they ask that they take some action into the future, but there's no claim that by acquiring the report or by authorizing the report that they in any way damage anybody. So there's no indication here as to what the amount of the amount of the claim, what the potential damages are, in fact, what the wrongful conduct is, or who the employees are that they claim have committed any wrongful act. So it's wholly lacking in all of those areas, as best as we can tell. And as we said in our petition, in some respects, it was conciliatory. It was, you know, can you help us here by withdrawing this report because we're in this dispute with the county?
Maybe you can help me. This isn't directly on point with the legal issue, but I'm trying to understand some of the background. Is the improvement authority looking to build the administration building and other buildings?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Improvement Authority is right now in the middle of a project with the City of Elizabeth. Yes.
Yeah, I'm asking that question because obviously, the plaintiffs here are renting space to the county, and they're concerned that you're about to put them out of business. I'm just trying to get squarely before me, what's going on under the surface.
Correct. And they have a lease, the Al Bender building, which is what it's euphemistically called, and the parking lot. And they have a lease through 2023.
Their position, is that you issued this report, you defamed them so that you could get the business and take it away from them since they were leasing space to the county. That's basically what's going on below the surface. Am I correct?
No, I don't think so, because the only thing that the improvement authority only facilitates the county projects. They literally run the county projects. So I don't think that there's nothing from these letters certainly at that point in time in 2017, there was no indication that the improvement authority would be building anything. All the improvement authority was doing was on behalf of the county studying the county's future needs, and then the county would ultimately make a decision. And by the way, the county has made decisions, none of which have been challenged by this plaintiff. So the improvement authority at that point in time had a very limited role. The limited role was, we want you to take a look at all of our facilities in Elizabeth and determine whether or not what changes should be made or how we should project into the future.
No, my question is not directed to whether or not there's been compliance with the Tort Claims Act notice, but eventually, the Improvement Authority has now taken on the job of constructing this administration building?
No, they're the redevelopment entity.
Okay.
So they're the entity. So they're the redevelopment entity. The County of Elizabeth has made certain declarations, and the Improvement Authority is essentially running a procurement for somebody to build a building, which will then be leased to the county. So we just act as the redevelopment entity here. We're not a party to any of these. It's not going to be our building that we're going to lease. So I don't think that's not our role, at least not in this transaction.
Okay, thank you.
The appellate division, Mr. Renone, was focused on the letters essentially alleging that the county and the authority and others were working against the plaintiff to undermine the settlement and cause damages. And the appellate division relied heavily on that in its conclusion that there was substantial compliance. Why is that not sufficient to give rise to substantial compliance?
Because first, I don't think there's anything in these letters that should have led the appellate division to that conclusion. Once again, the focus of these letters was the contract claim and the claim that there was a settlement that was being breached. There wasn't any reason for the authority, certainly to be put on notice, that there was any claim other than that. And I think the appellate division cut and pasted the words out of paragraphs and didn't, you know, the read on theory, which is sure there was a litigation hold, but the litigation hold said that we intend to go to court to enforce the settlement. Therefore, here's a litigation hold. And I think that's really what the appellate division should have seen. And also with regards to, and they never did make a distinction between the Improvement Authority and the county, because they are literally two different entities.
Had they gone to court to enforce a settlement, that would not require a tort claims notice, correct?
It would not.
It is purely be an equitable action to enforce a settlement.
Correct.
So to the extent there is a litigation hold notice that pertains to a potential action to enforce settlement, that would not support their contention regarding the Tort Claims Act. Am I correct about that?
Correct. That is correct. It would not.
You're also saying that their 1983 claim and state civil rights claim, if it has any merit, is not barred by the Tort Claims Act. You've already conceded that.
Correct. It is not. They're not required to do that. So I think you understand our position with regards to that. If I can, I would just like to take a couple of minutes to talk a little bit about the procedure here. One of the difficulties here with us trying to figure out whether or not a letter to an exchange of correspondence between attorneys constitutes a tort claim notice is that we then get into all of the procedural issues which were raised in this case about whether or not the objection was timely and should the county have told them that their notice was deficient. I just want to note, because I think it's important, and it's something that the plaintiff kind of glosses over, they waited more than a year after these March letters to file suit. They then complained that, well, we're out of time to leave to file a late notice of claim because you waited so long to raise the issue. But the fact of the matter is that they waited more than a year. And if we are going to, if as the plaintiff would like this court to do, go down that slippery slope, which is an exchange of correspondence here, equivocal, conditional, conciliatory, can constitute a notice of claim, then the flip side of this, if it's that equitable remedy, is that the person on the other side, you know, we have to balance the equities here, which is you have to pursue your claims. You can't, it's not, as far as I know, there is no requirement for a governmental entity when it receives a late notice of claim to litigate whether it's late or not. Typically those matters get litigated when a lawsuit gets filed. Well, if you wait more than a year to file your lawsuit and the public entity raises the issue of your claim being late and you're out of time to file it, to file a motion, that's not the fault of the public entity. And they're under no obligation. I know that plaintiff continually goes back to, well, nobody, Nobody objected to our notice of claim. Well, your notice of claim was filed in June. It was a date fixed. You filed your lawsuit and there was an objection. So I just want to make sure that if you're seeking equity, I think you have to do equity here. I think that you have to, you know, there has to be some burden. And this is not, as has been suggested, you know, a trap for the unwary. We are not talking about somebody who slipped and fell and didn't understand that the road was owned by the county and not owned by the municipality. We have very sophisticated counsel here. And in some respects, I think that if they're going to come to this court and argue that there's substantial compliance, that they need to show that it was clear, unconditional, unequivocal, and met all of the requirements of the Tort Claims Act. I think they're held to a higher standard because, after all, their knowledge is part of the context under which this claim should be reviewed.
Typically, under substantial compliance claims, there's an obligation to explain why compliance was unavailing, and why was there a need to then move to substantial compliance. Do you see that as a essential requirement for this analysis generally?
I think it is. I think especially in a circumstance here where the party's own actions seems to indicate that they don't believe that they had substantially complied because they filed a tort claim notice. And you can, in your appellate debrief and your appellate brief, call it supplemental, but there was nothing supplemental about that. It was a tort claim notice. And by the way, that tort claim notice wasn't filed against the improvement authority. It was filed against the county, and a copy of it was sent to the improvement authority. And in that respect, these parties has certainly understood in June, almost an admission against their own interest. In June, they understood that they needed to file a tort claim notice, and they did, and it was out of time. And you know, the substantial compliance is something that came to them late in this game.
Could you just elaborate on the point you made immediately prior to this one, that there would be problems allowing notices of claims to be going to counsel, outside counsel, here for the authority? How is that a particular problem for public entities generally?
Well, councils for public entities get all manner of communications from citizens and from attorneys. If we allow it to go down this road, then literally every OPR request that's sent to a public entity lawyer is going to have to be analyzed to determine whether or not that the question that's being asked is actually putting you on notice. There is a reason why there's some formalistic requirement in the Tort Claims Act. And I think that if you are required to put the entity on notice, assuming that you're dealing with, in this case, you happen to be dealing with general counsel, you could just as easily have been dealing with redevelopment counsel in this circumstance. But you now shift the burden, right? The burden now goes to the public entity lawyer to make an analysis of every communication they receive to determine whether or not that actually satisfies the tort claim requirement. And you will literally put people like me in a position where almost every communication will have to be forwarded to your insurance carrier just to make sure that this isn't the first notice of a claim, and that's the issue. So here, this is something, you know. Once again, there's no reason here. As a municipal attorney, I get letters from people that say your client introduced an ordinance and you should tell them not to adopt it. Oh, so is that a notice of claim? Am I to assume that they're going to file a tort claim after that? I don't know. Under this analysis, I probably should send it to my insurance carrier, because those kind of the exchange of correspondence between lawyers, most of the time are lawyers trying to work things out, I assume. But you know, I am very much concerned that as you start to get away from the formal requirements of the tort claim notice, you then are beginning to shift the burden on public entities to do a whole completely different analysis of correspondence that they receive in order to determine whether or not any of them constitutes a tort claim notice.
Are there any additional points you wish to make?
No, I have nothing further.
Any questions, Kim? Thank you, Mr. Renone.
Thank you.
Mr. Abadi.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, on behalf of the County of Union, our position is that the appellate division holding below, if permitted to stand, imposes an affirmative obligation on public entities to weave together a series of disparate communications to interpret and extrapolate a compliant notice of claim under the Tort Claims Act. As Mr. Renone pointed out in his argument, the appellate division rendered that finding below, notwithstanding the fact that the plaintiff's principal argument in the trial court and in the appellate division was that those letters did not in fact constitute a notice of claim because their tort had not yet accrued. So it is rather anomalous and unusual that the appellate division seized upon the substantial compliance doctrine when that was not even the primary argument of the plaintiff. And in doing so, the appellate division departed from the limited and carefully delineated statutory scheme of the Tort Claims Act and engrafted a new and expansive exception that is purely judge-made, that is contrary to the legislative intent. And because the legislature did not impose this exception when it has otherwise spoken in this realm, we believe that the court's holding is inappropriate and was an abuse of discretion, and it should be reversed. Secondly, and I'll get into this a bit later, the appellate division stated in dictum in its opinion that the letters have to be read in context. In fact, and with all respect to the panel, the appellate division did not follow its own advice and failed to look at the entire context of the relationship between the parties. And in so doing, also ignored and failed to pay deference to the trial court's own experience and understanding of the complete factual landscape of this case. And so to get back to my first point, and looking at this court's jurisprudence with respect to late tort claim notices, Beauchamp versus Amedeo, O'Donnell versus Turnpike Authority, and DD versus UMDNJ. This court's own jurisprudence speaks repeatedly to the fact that the exception is liability under the Tort Claims Act, and the general rule is immunity. And this court's also spoken very authoritatively with respect to the concept that the Tort Claims Act represents a limited abrogation of sovereign immunity. And in this regard, when there are exceptions to sovereign immunity, the legislature has spoken very carefully as to when those exceptions apply. And of course, one of the clear requirements is notice of claim. And this court's repeatedly observed as well that the notice of claim requirement is intentionally short, and it's intentionally, there's an intent to require certain observances of procedural formalities. And over time, going back to the Beauchamp case, the court observed that there was a looser standard associated with waiving irregularities in claim notices. And the legislature eventually stepped in and imposed the extraordinary circumstances exception. So what we have here is a statutory construct under which there is a default mode where there is immunity. In order to avoid immunity, a claimant must follow very particular statutory elements. And if you do not meet those elements, you are left with the extraordinary circumstances exception. And over time, this court and the appellate courts have had frequent occasion to touch upon circumstances where unusual things happen. Does the is the claimant disabled and unable to communicate or consult with counsel? Are there extenuating circumstances outside the control of the claimant that resulted in there being an inability to file the claim? In O'Donnell, it was the claim was captioned and entitled and addressed to the Turnpike Authority, but the lawyer sent it to the wrong entity. In all those circumstances, this court has excused those irregularities, and under the extraordinary circumstances, relief valve, if you will, has allowed claims to go forward. But what we have here in the appellate division going down the pathway of the substantial compliance doctrine is an endorsement of really a common law or judicial made doctrine that, if carried to its logical extreme, would substantially undermine legislative intent and graft new exceptions onto the law where there already is a clear statutory exemption and where the legislature has reacted over time to narrow those exemptions.
Mr. Abadi, in your petition, you say, rather than simply moving to restore the dismissed complaint, the plaintiffs filed an entirely new lawsuit. So are you agreeing or implying by that statement that if they had simply moved to restore the complaint, they wouldn't have had to send a new notice to the county?
Well, the original lawsuit was a breach of contract only. It was for breach of the lease. When fire in the Albinger building occurred, the county withheld rent because it was unable to occupy the building.
So if they restored the contract claim, could they have added tort claims without filing a new notice of tort claim?
No, because they never asserted a tort claim in the prior lawsuit. So in order to bring in a new tort claim, they would have been required to file a notice of tort claim and wait a period of time. And honestly, that situation occurs not infrequently with public entity actions where there's a mixture of statutory, contract, or tort claims. Sometimes litigants will file the tort claim and immediately file their contract or their statutory or their civil rights action, which is just as all been pointed out, doesn't require a tort claim notice. And then when the 6-month waiting period expires, they will then move to amend the complaint and add the tort claims. Because there was no tort claim in this case previously, the filing of the new action triggered a tort claim notice requirement. The court touched on this in some of its questioning towards Mr. Renone, is that typically in substantial compliance cases, which are very narrow and exceptions to the rule, and I don't suggest that the court should wipe that doctrine off the face of the map, there are definitely circumstances that are appropriate for the application of equitable doctrines. But typically in those cases, the claimant is required to put forth an explanation for why they waited. And, there isn't one evident on this record because, as I noted earlier, in fact, the plaintiff in this case argued that these notices were not tort claim notices because their claim hadn't accrued. So they're really in a difficult position and have stopped from arguing that it was their intention that these would be the tort claim notices. In fact, they obtained the county's form and filed it on June 13. So under DD versus UMDNJ, which we addressed in our petition brief, the court's already addressed this. In the DD case, there was a cease and desist letter, and there was a pre-suit meeting between the plaintiff's counsel and UMDNJ's principals where certain claims were discussed or threats were made or demand was made to retract or cure the breach of the plaintiff's privacy. But the notice of claim was not actually addressed until later. And this court said that was insufficient. In fact, the court went so far as to say the plaintiff's, the failure of counsel to timely file the claim, whether that is through inadvertence, neglect, or intention, I think it seems to be intention here that the plaintiff miscalculated the accrual date of the tort and then thereby filed the notice late. This court has said in the DD case that an attorney's neglect or conscious decision to not file a notice of claim does not constitute extraordinary circumstances under the Tort Claims Act. So when I look at the appellate division's opinion and read why the court didn't go down the extraordinary circumstances route and why instead it went to substantial compliance, which is a judicial made doctrine, it reads to me as if the court is opening a new path in the law that the Supreme Court has already closed.
Do you agree with the trial court setting of an accrual date of essentially March 8th, and then using that for calculating the timeliness of the notice of tort claim that was filed in June against your client?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, in terms of accepting the result that obtained from that ruling, I accept that. But I will say that I think that the trial judge was giving a generous and hospitable reading to the accrual date. So when I read in the respondent's briefs that we were only 5 days late, well, not so much. In looking at the entire record, my belief and my argument is that they knew of this much further in the past. And to give some factual context to that, the thrust of their tort claim is that the county and others repudiated the settlement agreement that was purportedly reached in 2015 and unilaterally injected this so-called study contingency and thereby slow walked it and came up with a negative result in order to avoid the consequences of the settlement. When I look at their complaint, they allege in their conspiracy count, specifically in this conspiracy account that's alleged against the county, that part and parcel of that conspiracy is the withholding of rent and the refusal to consummate the settlement. Well, the withholding of the rent, if that's an element of their damages and part of the retaliatory or the conspiratorial scheme, that dates back to 2012. If the question is that our initial act in furtherance of the conspiracy is the failure to consummate the settlement agreement, the county told the trial judge, Judge Happas, in 2015, we do not have a settlement. And the trial judge said, well, either try the case right now or take a dismissal and talk about settlement some more. The county had no, never was an agreement to settle. And that's law of the case. There were in fact claims in this lawsuit arising out of breach of the settlement agreement and to enforce the settlement agreement. The entire first part of this case below concerned the existence of an enforceability of that settlement agreement.
Mr. Bobby, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
In the Tort Claims Act notice that's filed in June, other than the civil rights claims that don't have to be covered by the Tort Claims Act notice, what claims are plaintiff alleging?
I'm sorry, in the Tort Claims Act notice that we received in 2017, was that
the question? Yeah, what are they, other than conspiracy and trade libel? But I'm putting aside the civil rights claims because they don't have to be in the Tort Claims Act notice. Go ahead.
The June 13 Tort Claims
notice, yes,
does reveal a whole panoply of claims against the county and others. And there's not really an argument on our part that notice was not substantively sufficient. It was simply late.
Okay, so my next question is, when do you say that, in your opinion, what was the accrual date for those claims, the various claims?
The accrual date.
Can you figure that out?
I think in one respect, no, but I will give you my explanation. No, because the plaintiff is stuck with the record they made. And in so doing, they've concealed from the record when they received the study. Their argument is that they received the study and that set in chain the course of events that led them to filing this suit. I don't know when they received the study. They haven't told us. Now, do they get a second bite at the apple? I don't think so. This was extensively litigated below. There were multiple rounds of motion practice, and they made a conscious choice to not put into the record exactly when they learned about the contents of this study. They clearly knew that it was in the works as early as 2015. They knew in 2015 that the county did not want to settle the case, but was willing to talk. And clearly they were in communication with the county council continuously over that period of time. And I would argue that it's not the county's prerogative, or it's not our burden to establish the accrual date. Whereas here, the plaintiff has concealed that information from the record and has been less than clear about when they came into possession of the study and what communications and what conversations took place between them and others. It clearly didn't drop on Mr. Fader's desk on January 20th, 2017 out of thin air. They knew it was coming. They knew it was in the works. The fact that the UCIA had retained Colliers to commission the study was the subject of a resolution adopted in a public meeting, and they were in contact with the county council about it. So I think that the court doesn't need to resolve this because the trial judge, the motion judge who heard these motions below, gave them every favorable inference, as perhaps she was required to do, and determined that they at least admit that they had everything by March 8th. And even then, the notice of claim was late. So in looking at it from in terms of equity, I only raise all this backstory to say that, no, when you're weighing the equities in this case, it's not that their notice was 5 days late. It's that they knew about this for years. And in fact, they filed the original lawsuit in which they only asserted contract claims in 2013. And they went through 2 years of discovery, and on the trial call, they weren't ready to proceed, or they wanted to continue settlement talks. And the presiding judge in Middlesex recognized that perhaps you'd get to do that. And they were guaranteed a 60-day dismissal. They never came back on the new trial date. And then they waited another 2 years to start this letter writing campaign. So certainly when one looks at the equities of this entire chain of events, what doesn't come across on the cold record and on a transcript is the trial court's consternation with the plaintiff's unwillingness to litigate its claims and its on again, off again approach. And in the meantime,
is tortious interference a continuing offense?
It depends on, it can be or it can't be. It depends. I think you can have tortious interference based upon a single event. If you steal a client from a competitor in an improper way, that single event may lead to.
I'm raising that because it seems as though plaintiff is claiming that the Improvement Authority and the county were tortious. It was a continuing set of actions. It was ongoing. It wasn't at a specific point in time. It was an ongoing movement. Am I mistaken in terms of what they're alleging?
No, you're not mistaken in that. That is their allegation. But I would point out first that with respect to tortious interference, we as an entity, the county as an entity, can't tortiously interfere with itself. That's settled law, the DeMaria versus InterArch, Printing Mar versus Morristowners, that's well settled. We were the principal to the purported settlement agreement and the lease. The county didn't need to undertake a conspiracy or a pattern and practice of tortious interference to undertake an action that it had unbridled discretion. You know, if a government entity wants to settle a case or not, it's virtually unreviewable. It's wholly within the discretion of the governing body. So I will say, this, not to get off on a tangent, but when we read these letters, these collection of letters, and there's threats of tortious interference claims, that necessarily excludes the county from liability. Those are claims against third parties, perhaps against individuals or others. I don't know. They still haven't articulated who they intend to sue. But by definition of the elements of that cause of action, it excludes the county.
And the county, just so I'm trying to understand law here, and that would exclude the county on a conspiracy count as well. Someone's, you're conspiring for someone to tortiously interfere.
Go ahead. Right, well, it's not, I don't want to argue the merits, but I do think it's a very thinly stretched
argument. It's not just the merits, because it implicates the accrual date and whether or not there's a cause of action. Because at least the June Tort Claims Act specifically mentions tortious interference, and it names Union County. Go ahead.
Well, right. So civil conspiracy has to be predicated on an underlying substantive cause of action. If they're relying upon an underlying cause of action of tortious interference, it doesn't follow against the county, because the county can't be party to a conspiracy to deprive itself of a contract. It's nonsensical. It makes no sense. And so therefore, when we read a tortious interference claim in a letter to the UCIA, why would the county be in a position to believe it's tortiously interfering with itself? It already made in 2015 a decision to not proceed with the settlement agreement.
Does that relate to your argument that substantial compliance can't be met here on the basis of these letters because of the lack of that level of detail as to what actors you might control? And upon recognition of a claim, stop bad behavior as the notice of tort claim is intended to allow the public entity to accomplish.
But from our perspective, we looked at that letter as we're refiling the breach of contract action that we dismissed in 2015. We want you, UCIA, to withdraw the Collier study. We want to be heard on it. If we're not gonna, don't get to be heard on it, we may sue you later. That sort of conditional language does not clearly put the county on notice that it's going to be sued in tort. It makes some conditional and ambiguous reference to third parties and others in the community. And we have fictitious party individuals in the complaint, even to this very day. I don't know who those third parties are because the plaintiff has never sought to substitute the fictitious party with the so-called co-conspirators. And so this whole case has been shot through with this ambiguity and lack of specificity that infects from its very beginning the tort claim notice, but carries through to this very day to the substantive substantive merits of its tort claims. They're just not sustainable. And so we're left with, I'm sorry, before I move on, I do want to answer in a little bit more detail the conspiracy continuing violation doctrine. The county made a decision.
When you do that, I don't mean to interfere because I want you to do that. Do it also with respect to the trade libel. Is the trade libel a continuing offense as well when you're responding to that question? Go ahead.
Great, thank you. Right, to that point, so the county made a decision to not settle the case. That decision was fixed in time in 2015. We then have the commissioning of a study whose retraction is demanded. And the plaintiff argues here that the continued existence of this unpublished study that had not been finalized at that point is a continuing violation. That sort of turns the law of libel and the law of conspiracy on its head. We do cite some cases in our petition, in our reply petition brief, for the proposition that the failure to right a wrong based upon a single occurrence does not convert that wrong into a continuing violation. And I think that what the plaintiff is trying to do here is say, well, so long as that study is sitting out there and we haven't issued a formal retraction and we haven't withdrawn it or repudiated its contents, the tort still hasn't accrued and it's a continuing violation for all time. If you carry that to its extreme, you're saying that anytime a public entity undertakes an act and declines to settle a litigation, it's perpetually committing a wrong. And that clearly—
No, so in the case of libel, it's on the date of publication. So I don't know, you have a better understanding of the record, whether or not they're claiming republication, because every time a libel is republished, the statute of limitations is typically set again.
Well, this study was never published. It was a draft that the plaintiff surreptitiously obtained. It was purely an internal working document that the county used as a framework. And as Mr. Renome points out, the county then moved on and started a construction project in order to build some buildings to move the staff to so that they could have an appropriate working environment. So the question of publication hasn't been alleged in this case. It's not in the complaint because the study was not posted on a website. It wasn't put out there. There weren't public statements made by public officials. The plaintiff simply left it out that we obtained this study that we shouldn't have had, that was really deliberative material that is arguably subject to deliberative process privilege and that we never had a right to have. And since we surreptitiously obtained it, we're going to use it against you and sue you. And so long as you don't retract your own deliberative materials, we're going to hold that against you and consider that a continuing violation. And so I would ask whether conduct like that is an appropriate set of circumstances where one should be entitled to avail oneself of an equitable doctrine. I don't think the plaintiff's conduct here is worthy of the dignity of that type of relief. especially where it's not couched in terms of a rather limited statutory framework.
Sir Bonney, do you have anything more that you want to add on the substantial compliance failings that you see and that you're alleging exist in the appellate division's analysis?
No, and I would just say in closing, I join in the UCA's argument that if adopted, this defense or this mechanism that was raised would lead to vast unintended consequences for public entities. There certainly are appropriate circumstances where a pro se litigant, an unsophisticated person, somebody who's not assisted by a series of able lawyers makes a technical defect on a claim where there should be appropriate relief. This is not that case. This isn't an appropriate vehicle to speak on that doctrine. On these facts, the plaintiff certainly doesn't have clean hands, and I think the appellate division reached too far in endorsing substantial compliance in this case. And so I would ask that the decision below be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Boxer.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The appellate division properly found that the correspondence sent in February and March of 2017 satisfied the notice requirements of the Tort Claims Act. And I think it's important to start with the statute itself. Under the statute 59:8-4, there are five things that HC Equities had to do, and it did them. It did them all. First, we had to disclose our identity and where we want responsive correspondence to be sent. I don't think there's any dispute on that requirement. In fact, counsel for both of these defendants sent us responsive correspondence, so clearly they know who we were and how we could be reached. The second requirement is that we had to set forth the, quote, circumstances of the occurrence or transaction at issue. These letters gave pages of background on the facts giving rise to plaintiff's claim, including the prior lawsuit with Union County, the allegedly false statements in the space study, and the actions allegedly being taken to frustrate the settlement that would have provided a long lease extension for my client. There is no requirement under the Tort Claims Act that we set forth specific causes of action. We don't have to name causes of action. The causes of action we mention do not have to satisfy some sort of motion to dismiss test, as counsel for the defendants would seem to imply in their argument. We have to set forth the circumstances of the occurrence or transaction at issue. Third, we need to provide a, quote, general description of the injury we sustained, quote, so far as it may be known. That was made very clear in these letters. My client had been promised a lucrative 20-year lease extension that, for political and other reasons, was now being pulled away from them. Fourth, we have to provide the names of the entity causing the injury, if known. And certainly, based on what we knew at that point, we didn't know all of the individuals involved in the conspiracy that has been pled in this complaint, but the names of the entities causing the injury was made clear. These letters were sent to two entities, Union County and the Union County Improvement Authority. They described the role in each in the facts I just mentioned. For example, the February 22nd letter addressed to both defendants lists possible causes of action, even though we didn't have to, lists possible causes of action, and then says, and I'm going to quote, the county and the authority are directed to immediately initiate a litigation hold, close quote. And it references the consequences at trial if they fail to do so. And lastly, under 59:8-4, we had to set forth any damage sustained, quote, insofar as it may be known at the time, and we explained the damages sought here would be in excess of $1 million. And when my client's suit was subsequently filed, it surprised no one. Union County filed an answer to our complaint that had 19 affirmative defenses, and there was no mention in any of those 19 defenses that they had any kind of qualm with the Tort Claims Act notice that had been provided. Similarly, when Union County initially made a motion to dismiss, they didn't even make a Tort Claims Act argument. They had an hour and a half long motion hearing on their motion to dismiss. They never even mentioned it as an issue. Under New Jersey law, a plaintiff needs only substantial compliance with the Tort Claims Act. Counsel mentioned extraordinary circumstances. That's a different issue. That's not the issue that brings us before this court. We're before this court because the appellate division in a unanimous decision said that there was substantial compliance. Arguably, there's more than substantial compliance. I just went through the five factors under 8-4, but we don't need to meet each one perfectly, as this court has said repeatedly. All a plaintiff needs is substantial compliance. Counsel's suggestion that the appellate division decision below somehow breaks some new ground, I'm not seeing it. This court has spoke positively of the substantial compliance doctrine. It's applied it. It's cited approvingly appellate division decisions that have applied it. What the court has said is that the notice just has to substantially satisfy the purposes for which such notices are required. And that absolutely happened here. If you look at the purposes of the notices of the Tort Claims Act as set forth in this court just a year or two ago, court said the notice has to allow the public entity a chance to investigate. Did that. Has to afford a chance to correct the conditions at issue. Did that. We were practically begging these defendants to revisit the incorrect statements in the study. And so to the extent that counsel suggested in their argument that there was some problem with these letters because they were conciliatory, I don't know that I would agree that the word conciliatory is the right word to use. I mean, the notices talk about pursuing all available remedies and prosecuting causes of action. One of the letters
Mr. Baxter, what about conditional or equivocal? And let's take the letter specifically, looking at the last paragraph on the bottom of the second page of February 22nd letter, which is one that was addressed to County Council. And then also the last paragraph let's look at that one first, and then we'll turn to the other letter that was sent to County Council. Let me point to you the language that at least caught my attention. Please be advised that if the draft Collier study is not withdrawn, Equities will act to protect its rights. Three lines down, HC Equities will likely proceed with its original claims and prosecute additional causes of action against the appropriate parties, including but not limited to, and then three torts are mentioned. And then in light of this eventuality demands the litigation hold. Is that language that you think is specific enough to be the equivalent of a notice of tort claim when later on your client used the form that the county wants such claims to be submitted on?
Yes. Absolutely, yes, is my answer, and I'm going to explain why I say that. And Your Honor makes a few points in there, so I want to be sure to try to hit each of those.
Sure.
The first point is, it's okay under the law if we're a little equivocal. That's okay. I'm not aware of any case that says the tort notice has to say we are filing suit no matter what, in a month. There's been no case that says that. And I would respectfully submit, if this court is going to say that, I would ask that ruling be made to apply prospectively, because we had no knowledge that we couldn't ask, we couldn't suggest that there would be room to negotiate. And one reason I say that, Your Honor, is that one of the very purposes of the Tort Claims Act, as this court has said,
would be to enable discussions about settlement to avoid a lawsuit. Like that's one of the reasons these notices that the legislature has these notices to get filed. So I don't think you can take from that in any way, well, you know, you got a say in this notice, you know, we are determined to go into court and file. Now that being said, I think that the letters are, even though they don't have to be, I think they are pretty resolute. I mean, Your Honor is correct in what Your Honor read, that it says likely proceed, but it talks about a litigation hold. It references what's going to happen, quote, at trial. It lists possible causes of action. And one of these letters says we will shortly be filing an action in Superior Court. I mean, any lawyer that gets a litigation hold notice and is told, hey, you know what the consequence will be at trial if you don't abide by this, I mean, that's pretty clear.
Mr. Boxer, with your knowledge of government generally in New Jersey, I mean, do you acknowledge that there might be problems for public entities if any letter received by a counsel representing a public entity can be regarded as the equivalent of a Notice of Tort Claims Act?
Well, to say that any letter can be suitable as a notice, that's not plowing any new ground. I mean, there have been case after case that has said in various situations where there's not an actual form submitted. Matter of fact, even the statute itself says local governments may use a form. Like you don't have to use a form. And again, I would ask if that's going to be the requirement coming out of this case, I would ask that it be perspective only. But that's first.
Okay, I accept that. I accept that response that addresses language in the statute. So take it one step further. How far should this court go in considering letters in tandem? You know, joining together, reading letters together to be substantial compliance? Because I've looked for cases where that has happened, and I was coming up short of any appellate case that has acknowledged that practice as being compliant.
Yes, so I would say, Your Honor, that it's fact dependent. It's fact specific. That's what this court has said. And I think, you know, that what we saw in this case is a respected appellate division panel that looked into these facts and was comfortable with these facts, but it is a very fact-specific approach. There are cases, for example, the appellate division case of Danch, there were emails exchanged over a period of days that were found to be sufficient. There are other cases.
In this case, Mr. Boxer, wouldn't it be problematic going forward for public entities if we were to find in a case like this where there's multiple correspondence with equivocal language, which we've already discussed, would that result in a situation where we would be requiring public entities to really sift through every and any correspondence that's received directly by the public entity, and even correspondence that's received by outside counsel to determine if piecing together all of these different correspondence constitutes notice? I mean, wouldn't that be problematic?
I don't believe it would be problematic. I represent government entities all the time. And if I got letters like this, the first thing I would do, and matter of fact, I would say I'm ethically required to do, is to provide them to my client and say, these folks are threatening to file suit. They have advised us and asked us to implement a litigation hold. And we need to address that. There was no mystery here. And again, the facts here, the context is important. These parties had previously been litigating against each other. Like there was no doubt that we were already here, really, in
right.
litigation.
So given, particularly with these facts, given the fact that there had already been litigation and that there was discussion of enforcing a settlement, in some of these letters, the ask seems to be withdraw this study, or we'll, you know, we will have to proceed to with its original claims in Superior Court. So not clearly indicating to some extent that it would be a continuation of the prior litigation, enforcing the previous claims, and again, making an ask that the study be withdrawn. And if not, we might consider filing a claim, not necessarily that we would be filing a claim.
Well we do say we will shortly be filing a claim. And the fact that we left open room for settlement discussions, to me is not any way inconsistent with what this statute requires and even what the purpose of the statute is all about. You know, there are plenty of entities in this state that speak on behalf of government units. None of them have appeared in this case to talk about all the crazy consequences that these defendants have claimed will result from this. And frankly, I don't see it. You know, the counsel for the county mentions an OPR request. This ain't an OPR request, respectfully.
Do you really think we should consider whether other amici have filed applications to become amici as something in your favor? Do you really consider that?
I say that, Justice, only in the vein of in the point of the other side making an argument about the consequences that would result. Well, let's look at what the record is before the court.
Well, that's fine, but I thought your suggestion was that because other parties haven't come in as amici, we should consider our argument frivolous or incorrect. And I just don't think that that's something that this court can do.
I don't mean to say that it's frivolous. The point was to focus on the information before the court. And what we've got is these self-serving arguments from these two parties with nobody beyond that making broader arguments about the consequences here. And frankly, as I say, I mean, I don't see it in terms of problematic consequences. There's again, the facts, the context matter. It's a very fact-specific item. There's a history of litigation here. There's a history of correspondence and dialogue between counsel. That dialogue continued. We sent these letters informing these parties of what we would do if the study was not changed. The study was not changed.
And well, that wasn't really my question. My question was regarding your comment that no one asked, I'd weighed in. The facts are the facts, and we'll decide what they bring us to. But my question was about your comment. That's all.
I take it in a nutshell, Mr. Boxer, two things. First is the letter of February 22nd and the letter of March 8th both describe the tort claims and other contractual claims you have and could pursue. And therefore, the county and the CIA are on notice and have an opportunity to do all the things the statute, the Tort Claims Act, allows them to do, namely investigate, correct, settle, et cetera. That's your first contention, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Secondly, though, is the February 22nd letter, is that the date that you perfected your claim? And the reason I ask that is, what's the accrual date? And was that timely?
Right. So, you know, this is where the procedural history of this case is important. And frankly, it gets a little complicated. We had argued before the trial court that if you look at the specific causes of action that were brought, that arguably the claim didn't accrue on the date that the trial court found. The trial court said, well, the claims accrued at the latest on March 9th. And my point before the appellate division was, well, even if we take that as correct, because I think there are good arguments to be made that the claims had not accrued then, and our appellate division briefing speaks to that issue in detail. But even if you take the trial court's decision on that point on its face and said, okay, these three letters show the claim had accrued then if these letters are enough for accrual, I mean, these these are the same letters that we sent to the other side. So there also should be enough for notice.
Well, and what is your position? Because the appellate division did not identify an accrual date. What do you have a position with respect to the accrual date? And if so, what is the accrual date?
So these letters, these three letters, were clearly within 90 days of any accrual date because the... I'm sorry, Justice.
Yeah, I understand that your position is no matter when the accrual date is, you're within time as to the three letters going to substantial compliance. My question is, do you have a position with respect to the accrual date as to your client's cause of action? And if so, what is it?
So our position is that these claims accrued first let me say this, the trial court didn't have a hearing on this issue. There were no facts developed on it.
Understood. But the normal process in this type of situation is that the plaintiff comes in with a proposed accrual date and explains why they're within time. And the court comes up with its finding with respect to an accrual date. So that's my question. You don't have a position as to what you can tell us that.
Yeah, the issue, Justice, is that we're making arguments in the alternative because I think we're permitted to do that. The claims when in the spring of 2017, we were still hoping that these studies, that this study would be changed. And that's what these letters show. And so our position was, it was in the late spring of 2017 when these claims accrued.
Now, the accrual date doesn't depend on when you thought you might sell it or not, what the studies may be. The accrual date is the date that you actually perceive some harm. And then all you're wishing about settlement, all your other, that's just your concerns, but that's not the accrual date. The accrual date is the date that you received the harm or recognized the harm, not what you thought later. It doesn't get told by your thoughts about perhaps settling or the complicated history. Yeah, so what is the accrual date according to you?
I didn't mean to suggest that settling had to do with the accrual date.
I just want an answer to my question. What is the accrual date according to you?
We don't know exactly what the accrual date is. It's in the spring of 2017, let me just finish the thought to try to explain that. It is an element of these offenses that you have to be damaged. And we were hoping that the draft study, which was only in draft form at that point, would be changed in its final form, and so that we wouldn't be damaged. And so that's why so that's what our hope was at that time, and we hadn't been damaged. So there couldn't be an accrual until, as I say, the spring of 2017. Now, what's the exact date? I don't have an exact date on that.
Is it fair to say that at the earliest, it was when the County Improvement Authority received the report, at least the draft report, at the earliest? You don't know at what point that information in the report or the communication between Colliers, the Improvement Authority, and the county blew up this agreement or this settlement you were trying to engage in. So you don't know the actual accrual date, but it's fair to say at the earliest in your position is it's January 20th.
Exactly right.
Position also that therefore your first letter in February and your second letter in March, or was that the second and third letters, were within 90 days?
Yes. And I think, Justice, that's why we didn't see in the appellate division decision an extensive analysis of this issue, because just looking at it, it couldn't have been any earlier than January 20th. And these letters are in February and March.
Do you agree that your claim turns on the issue of substantial compliance?
We made several arguments to the appellate division. The substantial—
Make your best one here.
Best one is this one, substantial compliance. But we do have others that we felt had—
Mr. Box, are you claiming that your February 22nd letter was the equivalent of a Tort Claims Act notice?
Yes, we are saying that it satisfies all of the statutory requirements.
So you're not— I mean, you're beyond substantial compliance suggests that there's some sort of defect that we will overlook. But I take it your claim is that your February 22nd letter isn't even a defect. It is the substantial— it is the equivalent of a Tort Claims Act notice. Am I correct in terms of your argument?
You are, Justice Albin. You're absolutely correct. I'm using substantial compliance, and I'm referencing that simply because, one, you know, the appellate division did, and two, it to make the point that we have a little leeway here, even if the court finds that there was some aspect here that wasn't 100% compliance, we don't need perfection. We just need substantial, but your honor is right. I believe that this satisfies all the requirements of the statute.
Go ahead, Justice Albin, sorry.
No, go ahead, Justice Pierre-Louis.
I was just going to clarify. So you believe that that letter standing alone, not read in conjunction with the March letters, that February 22nd letter standing alone is sufficient notice under the Tort Claims Act for both the county and the UCIA?
The only thing that I want to check, Justice, on that is the act does require that we indicate the amount of damage sustained. And I think it was in a later letter that we talk about the millions of dollars in damages. But I think other than that technical item, and there may have been something in that February 22nd letter about it, but that's the prong that why I mentioned the other letter.
The other letter referred to multi-million dollars in damages, I thought, to rent due. Was there something else that you're referring to, Mr. Boxer?
Well, I think our point there, Justice, is that they knew what the statute requires is the damage sustained, quote, insofar as it may be known at the time, quote. That's what the statute requires. We put them on notice that if we file this lawsuit, we're going to be talking about millions of dollars. That's consistent. I mean, I've seen complaints that don't get more specific than that.
I'm just asking because it seems to blend the contract claim with the tort claim. Was there some other reference to an amount somewhere that I missed?
Well, what it says is the original multi-million dollar claims, and then it indicates additional claims as well. So, no, I don't think you've missed anything, Justice. I guess my point is just the bottom line in terms of like the reality of what the statute requires. They knew that the lawsuit was going to be in the range of multi-million dollars.
Okay. So Mr. Boxer, I'm going to ask if you could bring your points to a close and if there are any further questions, because I
just have one question, my last question. Your adversaries are basically arguing that you're engaged in reverse engineering because you file a Tort Claims Act in June. Like, why would you do that unless you thought you had to do it in the form and in the manner in which you did it in June? And now you're going back and looking for some justification, particularly the February 22nd letter, in order to cover the defect. So if you could just briefly respond to that, I'll have no further questions.
No, I appreciate Your Honor asking that. And I will try to be brief, but it's going to take me a minute. First, let me say this, and then I'll answer specifically. The what we had in mind, I'm happy to talk about what we had in mind, and I promise I will get to that in a second. But what we had in mind is under the statute, not the focus of the notice inquiry. It's the focus of the inquiry, and there are cases that say this, including the decision from the appellate division. The focus is the notice that they got, not what we had in mind, but whether the notice was sufficient. Now, that being said, let me answer Your Honor's question directly, and I apologize for taking a moment. After we sent the February and the March letters, the months started to pass. It started to become clear that the changes to the draft report that we had demanded would not be coming. The June notice, as your honors will note, as you go through the record here, the June notice is no ordinary notice. It's more like a position paper. It's 12 pages of almost like a draft complaint. It's almost like when you send a draft complaint to your adversary saying like, hey, if you don't do something, we're gonna file this. It was basically, your honor, it was a last ditch effort to get them to reconsider their conduct by not just filling out the bare bones information on that 2-page notice that they have, but also trying to get them to reconsider their conduct by setting forth a full description of everything that happened. I know somebody mentioned before where the notice was sent. It was sent to Union County and the authority. The authority is listed in the notice as a responsible party. And so I wanted to mention that as well. In the form, it lists them as a responsible party. The Improvement Authority never came back to us and said, we're not quite sure, can you fill out our form? You know, it's not even in the record that they actually even have a form. But if they do, they never said, hey, can you fill out this form? Can you expand on this? We're not clear. They never did any of that. Justice, would you like me to sum up?
Yes, please.
So to sum up, I want to say, first and foremost, this is not a plaintiff that sat on its hands. And I say that because that's a factor that we've seen a lot in this court's prior cases on this point. This is a plaintiff that went to 3 different law firms. Those firms sent all sorts of correspondence over a period of months. And I think the appellate division properly recognized all of that. And the fact that to the extent there may have been some deficiency here, if the court finds that there was some deficiency, there has been absolutely no prejudice from either of these, sustained by either of these defendants as a result of any such deficiency. The court in case after case has said that the Tort Claims Act should not be applied in a way that becomes a trap of some sort, that cases should be heard on the merits where possible. In the Feinberg case, I think is a case pretty closely on point to this one, Justice Pollack decision. I'll wrap up by saying, Justice, that dismissing these claims would serve no interest of justice. We respectfully request that the decision below be affirmed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Boxer. Mr. Shalom.
It please the court. As you well know, the ACLU of New Jersey does not typically get involved in commercial disputes like this one. But we're mindful that not everyone who suffers at the hands of the government can afford a lawyer. And not only that, not all of those who can afford lawyers can afford lawyers like Mr. Boxer. And so we appear here today to ensure that this case is not decided in a way that significantly limits the substantial compliance doctrine for litigants who have meritorious claims against government actors, but might not be able to afford legal assistance. And so even though some pro se litigants may not be aware of the Tort Claims Act's notice requirements, those individuals should be able to get redress for their injuries as long as the public entity has enough information to investigate the claim. And that is really at the heart of the substantial compliance doctrine. We fear that the petitioner's position would effectively draw new bright line rules that would disadvantage pro se litigants with otherwise meritorious claims, even though the government entity has sufficient notice. That's our general position. I'll rest on our papers, but I'd like to just address one piece, which is I was concerned, Justice LaVecchia, by your questions about the equivocal nature of the claim, because this actually strikes me as a very common form of tort claim. Someone, particularly a less sophisticated litigant, might say, listen, I slipped and fell in front of your building and I was hurt and I have medical bills that are about $10,000. Either pay my medical bills or I'm going to have to sue you. That puts them on notice. That achieves all of the purposes of the act, and we shouldn't draw bright line rules that would exclude that sort of notice from counting because the person was being polite and seeking an alternative to pursuing litigation.
But
But that's not quite the situation here. My point, here, though, counts. No, go ahead, Justice Slovakia.
But my point in that questioning, Mr. Shalom, to allay your fears, is that we were dealing with requested action that related to past contract litigation. And our focus here is on a tort claim. I certainly understand your point about private citizens and their written submissions to government. And as you know, in DD, the court wants written submissions. So
it requires written submissions. That seems, that is clearly a portion of the Tort Claims Act that cannot be waived. But I also, so last point, and Justice Patterson, I'll respond to the fragment of a question that you got out there, which is I recognize that this case is not that. And all we ask in this case and going forward is that the court treat the substantial compliance as a fact-laden inquiry where the court gets into the actual questions of whether or not sufficient notice has been provided to the public entity. And I'm not asking for a particular application of the facts in this case. I think Mr. Boxer has ably done that. We want to make sure that whatever rules come forward won't harm pro se litigants. And I do think it's important because I noticed a little contraction in the petitioner's arguments of the extraordinary circumstances doctrine, which is obviously written into the Tort Claims Act, and the substantial compliance doctrine. And those are not one and the same. So you can have substantial compliance even where there are not extraordinary circumstances. And with that, we would rest on our papers unless there are any further questions.
Justice Patterson? No further.
No, my question's been answered, no problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel, for the fine arguments this morning.